Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Peggy Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and fellowship of people like you and sponsorship, I have been sober since February the 4th, 1964, and for that I'm very grateful. First of all, before I get carried away with myself, I would like to thank the Marietta Groups for asking me to come here and share with you. It's a great honor and a privilege, and one that I hope I never forget to be grateful for. Sandy and I were this has been just the most wonderful weekend, because so many of the people that are here have so many ties to me, and our lives have crossed and geographically and other ways that it's just amazing. It's one of those things where you kind of go do, you know, like, whoa, you know, wow. And Creighton and I used to spend summers at the Lake of the Ozarks within a mile of each other when we were kids. Dennis and Charlene got sober in Seneca House, and I got sober where the congressmen sent their wives, or now the congresswomen get sober, I don't know. in Washington, D.C., and we know a lot of the same people there. Sandy and I got sober in the same year, in the same groups, with the same people. So, it's kind of like two old war horses, you know? Because we've, like, really been through the wars, haven't we? And this is really too early for me to start this, but we shouldn't really be here. Neither Sandy or me. We shouldn't be here. We shouldn't be sober. We shouldn't be in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because he was worse than I was. We were pretty bad. We used to shake an awful lot. You know, we would sit in the friendship group in Washington, D.C., and I used to sit in the chair. My sponsor always made me sit up in the front row because I couldn't escape, you know, because I have to walk by her to get out of the place. And I was terrified of her, so I wouldn't move, you know, and I would sit there with my legs crossed like this, and you know how you're just so tight, and your arms are folded over like this, you know, and then every once in a while I just go out like this, you know. It would strike people walking by and everything. We really literally shook it out. I mean, I had been sober a month then. I mean, it was, you know, we literally shook it out. And Sandy was really worse than I was. And you should got to be here tomorrow, because he's one of the people in AA that have been my heroes. And I don't care what you think about not having heroes in AA, because this is, I mean, you can argue with me later, but I know I have my heroes, because they have been people who have participated in my recovery. And my heroes in AA are humans. They're human beings, and they do human being things. Sometimes they're jerks, and sometimes they're nervous, and sometimes they're neurotic, and sometimes they're angry, and sometimes they're depressed, and sometimes they're a lot of things. But they have helped me, and they have participated in my recovery. They have pushed me when I need to be pushed. So this is really a very special time for me, and I want to thank you for affording me the opportunity. And I hope I'm never too jaded and getting too used to being sober. I hope that never happens to me. I hope I never take AA and the wonder that is involved in AA and the thing I see in your eyes for granted. Because if I take it for granted for too long, I know that I'll lose it. And I don't want to lose it. You know, I have been sober for over 29 years now, and I have an awful lot to lose. And I don't want to lose it. I was amused by putting our butts in the receptacles, you know, and it reminded me of, we have at home, all of our meetings are non-smoking. They're all in churches, and they're all non-smoking now. And this one particular meeting on Tuesday night, which is my home group, is the Foxhall group of Alcoholics Anonymous in big old downtown Bellevue, Nebraska, and we have about 450 regular members that come there. And we have a newly elected official in our group. And at the last election, it was the most hotly contested office. It was butt picker. And that person's job is to pick up everybody's cigarette butts outside the meeting and put them in the can. And six people ran for butt picker. Who wanted to be GSR? No, I want to be butt picker! Anyway, I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to be sober. And I want to thank you for my goodie basket and my T-shirt and my cup, because I treasure those sorts of things. I didn't really plan to become an alcoholic. I was born to a doctor and his wife in St. Louis, Missouri, 54 years ago. We lived on what was called Dago Hill. And I was big when I was born, and I was red hair and a black eye and a bum shoulder. And today I don't have red hair and I don't have a black eye, but I've got a bum shoulder. And it wasn't in my mind that I was going to become an alcoholic. It just wasn't on my list of things to be when I grew up. But right from the very beginning, I was really weird. Now, maybe you are not a real alcoholic. Maybe you are one of these people who can grow new legs. You know, and I see people like that all the time in my groups. It's people that grow new legs, see, and they just sort of walk out of AA. But I'm still so weird in some ways. Now, I don't want to put you off on this because I don't want you to rush out of here and say, Jesus, I don't want what she has. You know, she's weird. But that's the way I think. I don't think like other people, and I never have thought like other people. I never have reacted to life like other people. Maybe you did. Maybe you did. But I didn't. I never reacted to life right. I always wanted it all. I've always been a pig. You know, I've always wanted everything. I wanted the full experience of everything. But it's like I was a human dichotomy. Do you know what that means? It's like a split person. It was like inside my head, there was this huge schism. And I'd feel this way for a while. I could be real, really good for a while. But then it got boring, and I didn't want to be good anymore, and I'd go over here and be really, really bad for a while, and that would get scary, so then I'd go over here, but I could never just be in the middle. I couldn't be just an ordinary kid. I always had to be doing something. When I was 3 or 4 years old, I climbed up to the top of a 40-foot pine tree in Pennsylvania, and I got up there fine. Then I couldn't move. And they had to send the fireman with a cherry picker to get me out of this tree, you know. And I loved it up there. I just couldn't get down. You know, I was like a cat. I was up there. I couldn't get down. I was scared then, you know. But I loved it. I was a mistress of all I surveyed from the top of that pine tree. And I remember that. I remember when I was in the sixth grade. Remember the Berlin Wall? Which I found was interestingly dismantled when Congress was not in session. But it was. Remember the Berlin Wall? Well, when they put it up, in the sixth grade, I was the chairman for the Berlin Candy Lift in the sixth grade at Randolph Elementary School, Randolph Air Force Base in Texas. And I was in charge of taking up the money to get candy bars for these kids. And there was a guy in our sixth grade class. He was a great big fat guy. He looked like an avocado. He had a little tiny head and great big hips. And he wore white nylon shirts, high water jeans, white socks, and tennis shoes with lightning bolts on the side. And we called him Flash. And Flash was the only one in the sixth grade who didn't bring any money in to contribute to this. And I told him, and I weighed 56 pounds at the time, and I said, Flash, if you don't bring in your money and contribute to this candy lift, I'm going to meet you after school tomorrow and beat you up. And he goes, whoa, I'm really scared. And, of course, he didn't bring in his money. And so the next day after school, I waited behind a bush, and as he passed by, I leapt out on him with a huge karate cry, and I took my fist and I shoved it up into his nose, boom, just like that. I could feel it crunch. It was the most satisfying sound. I can think of it today. I mean, it just gives me chills. I just think of the power I had, and I rode him all the way to the ground, and he hit the ground. His nose was bleeding. And I got up, and, oh, I got in so much trouble. I mean, I was an officer's kid, you know, and this guy was a sergeant's kid, and it was a big stink, and I was in my room for weeks because I have often said this, and, you know, especially when I go to Texas, I say, well, Flash, if you're in the audience, I would like to make amends to you. I was wrong for what I did, but I am not sorry. And I am not sorry. I remember that to this day. I do. And that was the sort of kid that I was. Was there anybody else who was a kid like that? Were any of you like that? I mean, that's the way I was. I didn't know for years what I didn't know whether I was a boy or a girl. I really wanted to be a boy. Because I didn't like wearing gloves, and I didn't like little short skirts, and I didn't like anything about, I didn't like dolls. I only ever had one doll in my whole life, and I named her Mugsy. And I operated on her all the time, and she had appendectomies, and tonsillectomies, and hysterectomies, and my personal favorite, hemorrhoidectomies. And I had, my dad's a doctor, you know, and I stitched this doll up all over the place. I got tired of her one day because she was in ill health. I mean, she had so many scars all over. And I was taking a nap one day and nothing was going on, so I threw her out the window. And my mother said to me several days later, whatever happened to Mugsy? Where's Mugsy? And I said, my mother told me this. I didn't even remember this. My mother said to me that years later she related this, and she said, you told me that Mugsy had become depressed over her ill health and had committed suicide. I was 5 or 6 years old. This is not normal. This is not normal behavior. And we went around, dug in the leaves, and here she was, you know, all moldy and everything, out laying out in Rock Creek Park somewhere. Gee, that's weird. That's not, I mean, that's, you know, when Clancy, who's another one of my heroes, talks about that disease of perception, the idea that we don't think or see things like other people. I know it's like that. This is, today, when I go into my own mind, it's like a walk in a dangerous neighborhood sometimes. It gets kind of bad in there sometimes. I mean, it's weird. I mean, I have thoughts today like, you know, what would happen if I, like, got sucked out the window of a jet airliner or something, you know? And I know these are not reality. You know, I know that I'm sitting there looking cool, you know, doing my crossword puzzles and stuff while I'm on the airplane. But I think things like that. What if people knew what we were thinking? You know, they'd stay away from us. You know, that's the way I lived. I lived like that. And I thought, the funny thing about it was, I thought that was a normal way to live. Now, this was before I ever really drank. I mean, this is my alcoholism. I hadn't had anything to drink yet. Drinking restored a semblance of sanity to me. I could settle down a little bit when I drank, you know. And I was always really kind of skinny, you know, when I was growing up. I never had a figure. I looked like a picket out of a picket fence. You know, I just had no figure. And other girls, long about 13 or 14, when I discovered that that's what I was, because I couldn't tell. I mean, you know, people said I was, but I couldn't tell. And other people were starting to get waists and hips and boobs and everything, you know. And I had nothing. I had nothing. I looked like a slat, a clothes prop, you know, kind of like that. And when I began to drink, I will never forget the romance. Oh, can you remember it? I think that's why we're alcoholic. We can remember that stuff. You know, other people, you say, do you remember your first drink? And they say, why? You know, I remember my first drink. You know, I remember how it felt. I remember it going in and it slid down. Oh, and the first little odor, I love beer, you know, and I'd snap the top off of that thing, you know, because we had to use church keys in our days. They were absolutely, you know what a church key is? That thing, the beer opener, it opens the door to heaven. That's why they call it there. And I would open that thing up and they'd get a little whiff of skunk. Remember? And then it'd go in, slide down, and it'd get down here, and my waist would nip in, and my hips would flare out, and my boobs would grow, and it was wonderful. It was magic. It was absolute magic. It changed everything. It changed me. I had boobs. It changed. I was not blessed by the chest fairy. No, and when I drank, boom, I was just Dolly Parton, you know, and the nice thing about it was I really didn't want boobs, you know, but it was nice to have them on call, you know, kind of like on call. You could have them when you want them, when you didn't want them, screw it, you know, you could just have them off, you know, and that was, hey, it's funny, but it's magic, that's magic. I mean, it just made me like Tinkerbell, you know, I could talk, I could laugh, I could forget things, you know, I could be in the backseat cars with people who made me want to throw up on them the next day, you know, and I could think they were wonderful that night, and they weren't wonderful, but those were the good times when I was drinking. It was something, and it just made the hair on my arms stand up. You know, it made me beautiful. It made me forget that I was this person who felt like everybody knew there was something wrong with me. Because essentially, from the beginning of my life, in my dangerous neighborhood, I always thought there was something wrong with me. Something deeply, deeply wrong with me. But I couldn't tell anybody because they look at you funny when you try to... You know, when somebody asks you at the office or something, how are you today? They don't want to really know. They just want you to say, I'm fine, fine. They don't want us to say, well, I'm loaded with resentments today. They don't want to hear that. You know, they just want to hear, fine, fine. But that's what we would say, wouldn't we? Or, I'm so scared, I don't know what to do. I'm terrified. Of what? Oh, I don't know. Just scared, you know, and general purpose fear, you know. I'm just shivering in my shoes. I've got goosebumps all over. From what? I don't know. But something's going to happen. And when I was a kid, too, I found a golf ball. I found many golf balls, but I remember the first golf ball I found. And I was a curious person, too. So I took this golf ball and I cut it open. How many people in here have cut open golf balls? Let me see your hands. See? Look at this. Okay. Now let me tell you something. I think we can just like cut out MMPIs. You know, those are those fancy tests we take. And they cost money to take them. We could just say, have you ever cut open a golf ball? And if you have, we can say, we think you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, because you can just cut out all the stuff in between. Just because when I cut open, I cut through that dimple part, which was the thing that insulates it, sort of the outer shell. And I took that off, and inside was this miles and miles and miles and miles of rubber band. And I got to going and going and going. I had a little pile of it down here, and I thought, oh, phooey on this. So I took a knife, and I just cut right through that stuff, threw it off, and there was this little ball right down in the middle. And I tried cutting into it, and it was really hard. So I took a hammer, my usual subtleties, and I went bam, just like that, and this black stuff just squirted out all over. And I related to that golf ball. That's how I felt. I felt like I was this dimpled shell, getting more dimpled all the while, of a person that was insulated from life by miles and miles and miles of rubber band, but that down inside there was this impenetrable core that was rotten. And I didn't know what to do about that, because that scared me to death, because I like thought that that was a hopeless state of mind and body. Come find out it was. But I didn't know any answer to it. That is what's so intriguing and so fascinating and so, to this day, absolutely enthralling to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, is that it is the solution. It is the solution for a fatal flaw. How many of us will die? How many of us will die? 35 out of 36, some people say, will die from alcoholism. And here we have the answer. Here's the solution to this problem. And you know what I had to do? Here's the magic for me. For some reason, the key to getting into Alcoholics Anonymous and staying in Alcoholics Anonymous is something that is anathema to me. I have to surrender. I never wanted to surrender. But in order for me to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to give it up. Whatever it is, I have to give it up. And it is my personal opinion that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and Sandy can tell you, I didn't surrender. I was surrendered. I was surrendered by the events in my life. Have you ever thought back on your disease of alcoholism as though it was a mosaic? Do you know what a mosaic is? It's a picture made up of a whole bunch of little colored stones. Lots of little colored stones. And when you're up really close to it, you can't see what that picture means. But the further you get back from it, the more you can see the picture. And there were people in my life. People were the last thing that I wanted in my life. Because if people were in my life, then they would see what I thought I was, that horrible, tragically flawed person, and if those people saw what I was, they would not like me, they would reject me, they would run away screaming, I don't know. I just knew I would die if they ever knew what I was. But the answer, the solution, is also in the people. Now, certainly it's God, but God has never come down and directly spoken to me. I understand he does to some people, but most of them are in nut wards. You know, I mean, really, they don't hear God speak. I see God. I hear God. I see him in your eyes. He speaks to me through you. And just this last weekend, I was in Quincy, Illinois, and this wonderful young man that I just love him to death, his name is James, and he's a tall kid, and he's about, I guess, 21 years old, and he's in college now. And he's been sober about 3 years, and I saw him get sober. And last weekend, he was helping me, because I was working, too. And he was helping us both a lot. And I said, James, you don't have to help us this morning. You've helped all weekend. He said, oh, never mind. He said, my sponsor says I have an untapped reservoir of guilt. Just use it. God spoke to me through James. I was surrendered. It was the last thing that I wanted to have happen to me. But I remember, do you remember people, little moments, little fragments, little colored stones in your life when people said things to you that for some reason you remember? Just tiny little things. There was a doc, when I went to school in Paris, get to the interpreter school. And then I went to the interpreter school in Geneva, Switzerland. I graduated as an interpreter in several languages. And in Paris was where I first started drinking wine on a daily basis. And I had two friends in Paris, good friends. One was, her name was Lillian, and she was an Englishwoman. And she was the secretary to the Secretary General of NATO, which was a big, big job. And we did a lot of things together. But I only ever remember her saying one thing to me. She said, some people can drink. Some people can't. But I think you drink too much. And I remembered that. And then there was a social worker from Morocco who was also in my boarding house. Her name was Katerina Moussar. And she said to me, Peggy, some people can drink and some people can't. And I don't think you can. And you know what she did for me? And it was a little thing. But she was trying to help me. And she's another of the little mosaics, little stones in the mosaic of my alcoholism. She sent me to do good work. There was a French prostitute. I don't know why I'm crying. There was a French prostitute. And she was dying. I don't know what. If I always washed my hands when I left, I know that. But she spoke English, and no one else would sit with her. And so Katerina suggested that I ride the metro and I said, and sit with this lady. And I went and sat with her one week. Oh, for 3 or 4 months. And then one day they just called me and said, don't come back, she died. And nobody cared about her. Nobody cared whether she lived or died. She was buried in a pauper's grave. And Katerina was trying to help me by giving me something to do, by showing me that I should be grateful for what I had and not feel sorry for myself and resentful and angry as the natural state of the alcoholic. And about 3 months ago, maybe a little more, in our town, we have a member of our group that's on the police force. And she called me up one day and she said, did you hear about the lady? And I said, no. And she said, well, there's some little cheap apartments on the highway in our town. And the landlord was trying to get his rent out of this lady. He hadn't seen her. She hadn't paid her rent. So he had the police come. And they broke in her door. And she was in there. There were 23 empty bottles of vodka and a box of Wheat Thins. And she'd been dead for 3 weeks. She was 54 years old. How old I am. Nobody called for her body. Nobody cared. She she'd worn them all out. And that could be any of us. It should have been me. But it could have been any of us. Because they just can't care anymore. Just like Helena. People couldn't care about her anymore. So that little stone is in the mosaic of my disease. And the lady in the apartment is a stone in the mosaic of my recovery. And then there was Dr. Hintzler, who was the first doctor who ever said to me, "How much do you drink? Do you drive around in your car? Do you have beer on the floor? Do you hide it around the house? Do you drink when nobody's home? Do you try to hold your breath when you're walking past people you know? Do you suck in your breath when you get in elevators?" He asked me all these questions. And my first thought was, my folks reported me to him. Because my daddy was a MAT surgeon at the time. And I thought they'd been telling on me. And I went home and I said to my mother, "Mom, have you been talking to Dr. Hintzler?" Because I couldn't say, "Mom, did you tell Dr. Hintzler how much I drank?" Because, I mean, you can't admit that, can you? But I said, "Do you talk?" She said, "No." And last Wednesday, when I was having tea with my parents, my daddy's 84 years old, my mom's 81, I recalled that incident. We hadn't talked about it for 20 years. And I said to Dad, "Dad, did you ever say anything to Dr. Hintzler?" And he said, "No." So Dr. Hintzler knew. And I remembered that. And I found out where Dr. Hintzler is. And I'm going to write him a letter. And I'm going to thank him. Because he was one of the people who cared enough about me to ask those questions. And he's one of the people that's in that mosaic. He's one of the little colored stones. My first sponsor. See, I didn't get here to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was smart or because I was young or because of anything except that I was a terrible drunk. And they laid me out on the porch at Melwood Farm, February the 4th, 1964, in a snowstorm. And that was the beginning of my recovery. But I didn't get here because of the complicated things that is in this dangerous neighborhood. The reason I got here was very simple. Some people, it takes more than this. But when you're being surrendered by the events in your life, even your sister, who is a very, very shiny stone in that mosaic of my recovery, is important to you. Because my sister and I shared a bedroom forever, ever and ever. And she was beautiful. And she had blonde hair, and she had no zits, and she always had a nice little figure, and she wore Lon's dresses, remember Lon's dresses? And she wore horsehair petticoats, and she had perfume, and friends, and she was real popular, and, you know, all that sort of thing. And I just absolutely hated her. She made me want to throw up, you know, she was so good. And she and I had the same bedroom. And her bed was always made up and always had these little stuffed animals on it, and it was always clean over on her side of the room. And my side of the room was just a wreck. It was never made. My bed was never made up. I always had beer cans rolling around underneath it. I always was on a diet because I was fat, and I had dried up celery and stuff in the plate on my bed. And one of the things that I was a beer drinker primarily. Well, any other beer drinkers in here? What is it you have to do when you drink a lot of beer? You have to go to the bathroom. I did not get here by being surrendered by head things. I got here surrendered by some real simple things. One night, each of us had a little chair and a little desk and everything in our bedrooms. And one night, you know, when you drink a lot of beer and you're struck drunk, you know, have you ever just like been struck drunk, you know, where you're just, all of a sudden you're just drunk. You know, you just, oh! You don't know how it happened. You're just going along fine. All of a sudden, you're just drunk. And that's what happens with beer. You can go along so long, and then you're just blitzed, you know. And I would, like, get blitzed and fall in bed and forget to go to the bathroom. So one night in a blackout, I got up out of bed, and I went over, and I opened the closet door, and I knelt down, and I peed in my shoes in the closet. But, you know, this is not one of those things that you want to ask questions about. You know, you don't want to say, well, what was I doing over there? You know, you don't want to really know, because it's not something you share with people. You know, you can't go to school the next day and say, oh, guess what I did last night? I peed in my shoes. You know, they don't want to sit next to you. You know, they don't want to have anything to do with you. But I did that, and I thought in my dangerous neighborhood, well, anyone could have made that mistake. It's a door. You know, it's a door. It could happen. And so I sort of passed it off. I just was glad it was my side of the closet. You know, I was glad it wasn't her side of the closet. Anyway, but then this one night, you know, my sister used to roll her hair up with those curlers that have brushes in them. You know, those things that just, it makes your head hurt to think about it. You screw them up and then you put these swords through them, you know, and it just stabs in there, and it just, when she'd do that, it would pull the skin of her face back to her eyelids like this. And she would look at me, you know, like she smelled something bad, you know, all the time. She was just really looking down her nose on me. Well, this one, I had a purse. There's a bunch of bass fishermen in this group that I'm running around with, like Mike and them. And I had this purse that was the style then to have this, it looked like a fisherman's creel. It had rope and it had a wooden lid in it. But it was a purse. Nowadays, a while ago they had them, they piled fruit on the top of them or flowers or something. But this thing didn't look like it. It was just rope and it had this wood thing on the top. And one night, you know, I don't know what happened, but the next day I got up and I went over and I looked at my purse. It was sitting on my little needlepoint chair, and it looked terrible. It looked like it had a nervous breakdown or something. You know, it was flat. It was just flat. And I opened it up, you know, and I go, oh, my God, like that. And my sister rose up out of all these stuffed animals that she had with that Al-Anon look on her face, you know, like this. And she goes, I believe you peed in your purse. And I had, you know. But I dried out the money and spent it anyway. I was no fool. I was in Southern California and I was a winette then too. Bought 6 packs of Thunderbird. Which, that wine never saw a grape, I know that. But that's not, you know, people say now, it's so, you know, it's fancy because they all say, use 75-cent words like, alcoholism is the disease of silence. You damn right it is. I mean, what can you do? Go to school the next day and say, I had one friend there. He wore a black cape, and he smoked dope. And he was a poet, had a black hat, and I called him Zorro. You know, I said, what can you go? Go to school and say to Zorro, hey, Zorro, guess what I did? I peed in my purse. You know, you can't. That's a disease of silence. And besides, you know what it says? That we are powerless over alcohol and makes our life unmanageable. I didn't have to go any further. I was powerless when I drank. I couldn't even figure out where I was going to whip. I mean, I went anywhere. One time, close to the time I got sober, I was walking down the street in Washington, D.C., and all of a sudden, there's blue-haired old ladies in here who are going, ew, but I'm sorry, this is powerlessness, this is unmanageable. I mean, that is the basics of unmanageable. I'm just walking along, and so I had to take a giant jump to the side, sort of like to quit leaving a trail or something, you know, it was hideous. And I rushed into this office building downtown, right off of the park down there, off Lafayette Park, rushed into this office building, ran into the bathroom, ran into the stall, and was, you know, and I heard these men's voices. And I had gotten in the men's room. And I was drunk. I mean, God, it takes a lot of energy to live a life like that. You know, it just takes everything you've got to live a life like that. And I go, what do? You know, I am drunk, and I jump up on the stool, and I'm hanging on that hook on the back of the thing, just squeezing back and forth, and God, get me out of this one, get me. Because that's the only time I asked God for anything was when I was in deep kimchi, you know, right up to my ears in trouble. And then I was very fervent in my prayer, but not until then. And so, and I hadn't been raised to be like this. I was raised a lady, sort of, you know, sort of. I'm more of a lady now than I ever thought I'd ever planned on being, ever. But I mean, I was raised by a lovely family. And when I first started talking in AA, my mother said, do you have to tell me about that peeing and stuff? You know, I mean, like, you know, you're from good family. And I said, well, Mother, good families have drunks in them, too. And that's what I was. I wouldn't have in my whole right mind done that sober. You'd lock me up. But that's alcoholism, isn't it? So it didn't take very much when they threw me. Well, the thing that got me which really finally surrendered me to into Melwood Farm was I looked in the mirror one day and I thought, the only thing I had left, I mean, this was a work. You know, do you ever get to the place, I know women get this way and I'm sure men do too, where you say to yourself, I'm just going to shape up. Just shape up. Shape up, Peg. Shape up. You're going to get up in the morning and eat something, you know. You're going to not drink, and you're going to walk and exercise, and you're going to put on your makeup, and you're going to get dressed, and you're going to do something valid for the day instead of, you know, just laying around sotting all day long in your chenille robe. And I would get up, and I would get over, and I'd put on my gray sweatpants, and I'd put on my blue turtleneck sweater, and I still have those. They should be bronzed, really, but I have them in my closet to remind me. And I would try to put on makeup, but see, I never took off the makeup I had on before. So I had these eyes that looked like two tarantulas had parked on my face, you know, just like that, you know, with this. And I would try to, you know, and I'd try to put mascara on over the top of the mascara that was on, and it was hideous. It was awful. But I tried to shape up, you know, and this one day I was looking over at myself like this, and I just, it was the only thing I had left. I weighed 150 some pounds. When you pushed in the fat, it stayed in, you know, it was just like fluffy body of some sort. I had yellow eyes and streaks all over my face, you know, and these tarantulas in the middle of my face, and my hair. I had one side that I passed out on all the time. I don't know, it was my passing out side. You know, there's a side you pass out on and the side you don't, and I passed out on this one side all the time, and my hair was real flat over on that side of my head. And I had, do you remember those little tiny blue bows we used to, or little bows we used to put in the side of our head, Charlie? And I'd have a little blue bow mashed into my head over on this side. And I'd look in the mirror, and I thought all my eyelashes were falling out. I saw them, like, raining down on my cheek. And I thought, oh, Jesus, that's it. It's gone. Everything is gone. I've had it, you know? And I just started to cry. And it was the first genuine tears that I had wept. And I sobbed, and I sobbed, and unbeknownst to me, my parents had been going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mother heard me. They kept me in the attic. I had an attic bedroom. And they kept me in the attic. And when I came into AA, I had a black eye, and I had a broken ribs because I used to fall up and down the stairs all the time from the attic, like Charlene. My mother heard me crying, and she came up and she got me, and they threw me on the porch at Melwood Farm, and I have been sober by the grace of God and people like you ever since. Now, my life in AA is, the mosaic of my life in AA is so wonderful that it's not perfect. I married an alcoholic. I met and married an honest-to-God newcomer. I had to get my sponsor's permission to do so. We had to call his sponsor. old lovable Bucky Doyle, who's gone to the big meeting in the sky now. We had to call him to get permission to get married. And it's been one of the best things that's ever happened to me, because he's one of the mosaics in my stones and stones in my recovery. He has given me the humor to look at myself and to not take myself so seriously. Do you remember when I first walked into the meeting, this lady walked up to me and said, "You look new. You look like you need a sponsor, and I'll be it." I laugh today. People come and interview me to sponsor them. You know, they take me to lunch and ask me questions and stuff, you know, like whether I'm going to be good enough for them or whatever. And in those days, we did not do that. I mean, this lady walked up and took me, and I was scared to death of her. She had iron gray hair. Sandy probably remembers her. Jane, she's gone to the big meeting in the sky now, too. And she had marcelled her hair, you know, where it had these crimps in it. You know, remember those Marcel machines where they had these electric things that hung down with the curlers on the end? And they crimped your hair up. Remember those, Creighton? And it was just like she'd crimped. They were permanently creased. And I felt like that if she ever got really mad at me, she'd just put her head down and ram me with those things. And it would just obliterate me, because I was real shaky anyway. You know, I was just totally, ooh, you know, like a dog on the freeway. Ooh. So I didn't. She said, "I'll be your sponsor." And I said, okay, you know. And she made me do some things. She made me sit in the front row. She made me greet people. She said, "You're going to be a greeter." And I said, "I don't want to be a greeter." She said, "I didn't ask you whether you wanted to be a greeter. You're going to be a greeter." And I said, "Well, as long as I don't have to. I mean, you know, as long as I don't have to want to, I'll be a greeter." So I was starting to be a greeter. And I was scared to death. I had a mirror at home that I used to, when I was drinking, I used to take off all my clothes and leap around in front of this mirror, because I always wanted to be a ballerina, you know, and I could never quite get my feet together. I'm always real clumsy. So I just get drunk and get naked and jump around all by myself in front of this mirror. Well, when I got sober, this little stone in my recovery, I'd stand in front of this mirror and I'd practice greeting. I'd say, "Welcome to the friendship group. Welcome to the friendship group." And then I'd try to smile. You know, because when you're new, I mean, how did you smile when you were new? I mean, I didn't like go a genuine smile. I just went, "Err." It was like an earthquake of the face or something, because I had been so unused to smiling. I could frown and cry and like that, but I hadn't used any up muscles in a long time. So when I would sit there, you know, and I remember Evelyn came and talked at the friendship group, this wonderful black woman. And she said she was from the city of brotherly love. And when she was drinking, she some kind of loved them brothers. And I laughed. I just went, you know, I just, ha, ha, you know, like this. And I scared myself. You know, I really scared myself. But I believe that laughter is God's music in the end program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot feel another emotion except joy when I am belly laughing. When I am belly laughing, there is just nothing like it. I defy you to feel anything but joy when you're laughing. And that's God's music. I think when he's cruising around the earth and everything sometime, and he sees all these tragic things, like in Bosnia and other places, that he gets depressed. My God gets depressed. And he says, "I think I'm going to take a night off. I think I'm going to go laugh. I think I'm going to go to an AA meeting." I think he says that because we laugh when we should cry. And we laugh. And it's like I've got this cosmic zipper on the front of me. And it's like when I laugh, it goes like this. And there's a toothbrush, a big, huge, God cosmic toothbrush. And he comes down and he says, "Honey, you're getting a little dirty inside. I think I'll give you a clean up." Like this. That's what laughter does for me, because it takes me out of me. I'm at my worst when I'm thinking about me. I'm at my very worst. I'm in my dangerous neighborhood. I'm crazy when I think about me all the time. I mean, spend 15 or 20 minutes with me alone, myself, and I can destroy the world. I mean, I can just... And I... So, God says, "Child, you're my child. You're my kid." Like Chuck Chamberlain says,
I'm going to clean you up. And it's like, that's the actions of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that there was this wonderful deal one time I saw where this guy, I get so excited I kind of jump around, but there was this guy that's taking care of his kid. And his wife went somewhere, I don't know. And you know how kids are when you get on the phone or when you're doing something, when you're trying to work. They come and, like, pull on you. Like that, you know? And so this kid was bothering his dad all the time. So his father found this map of the world in a magazine. And he took this map of the world out and he cut it into puzzle pieces. And he tossed them in a bag. And he gave the kid the bag, and he said, "Son, go put the puzzle together of the world, and then we'll go to McDonald's, okay?" Figuring it would be a half hour at least, and he could finish his work, and they could go to McDonald's. The kid came back in less than 2 minutes. And the father said, "Well, son, did you get that together?" And the son said, "Yes," and he showed him. And he said, "How did you do that so fast?" And the son said, "There was a picture of a man on the other side. And I put the man together, and the world came together." That was it. That was always it. It was never the world. It was me. It was always me. And as long as I remember that, as long as I take responsibility for my own recovery, as long as I know that I am the problem, and I have you and God as a solution and the steps and book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have all the hope in the world. All the hope in the world. If it's someone else's fault, I have absolutely no hope at all. And you know what hope is? Think about hope. What is hope? Dennis said it. Creighton said it, that hope is what we get. The beginning of hope is what we get when we come to the fellowships of AA and Al-Anon. Hope is honesty, open-mindedness, persistence, and enthusiasm. Because we can be honest and we can be open-minded, but if we don't stick to it, if I don't stick to it, today, after 29 years of sobriety, I could grow new legs. I could walk out there. I could cut back on my meetings. I could cut back on my sponsorship. I could just sit back and take it easy and rest on my laurels. But I would grow new legs. And I would walk out of here. So I have to be persistent and consistent in the discipline. I can have anything as long as I submit this dangerous neighborhood to the actions of meetings, sponsorship, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the actions of the steps, and someone else to talk to. As long as I submit that I am persistent in that, I can have the enthusiasm that is nothing but the God within trying to get out. When we laugh, isn't it the good in us that's laughing? Isn't it the kid that's laughing at stuff? Isn't it looking at things in a funny way? And if you want to hear somebody looking at things in a way you've never heard, you better be here in the morning. Because you'll hear it. But it's the enthusiasm. It's there. It's not something that we never had. I always knew what was right. Didn't you? I always knew what was right. The problem was that I had gone away from all of that. And I had to come back and relearn those things that I had forgotten a long time ago. It was like a whole new deal. It was like a whole new deal. And I need that enthusiasm to keep going. I need to keep being persistent and enthusiastic. I need to show you the God within. You need to be able to see it in my eyes. And if I am not a meeting maker, and if I don't put myself out for the people that I sponsor, you will not see that light in my eyes, because I won't be there, and it won't be there. There are people in this room who will die from alcoholism, like the lady did in the apartment. and I don't want to be one of them. So I always want to have hope in my life. And the only way I can do that is to shut your message out. And shutting your message out for me means I just close my ears. I judge you. I am not tolerant of you. I don't listen to you. I think I know best. I won't take suggestions. My ego gets out of whack. I ease God out in every area of my life, and I'm in trouble. And that can happen to me today just as easily as it happened to me 5 years ago or 10 years ago if I am not hopeful of my recovery. So I met and I married this guy in AA who has been a great part of my recovery. My sponsor was a great part of my recovery. We moved. Of course, we had a child. We had a baby born dead, which was a whole story in itself. And God pulled me through that through people in Alcoholics Anonymous. My son was, you think these are wrinkles, don't you? My son is an alcoholic. You think these are wrinkles, don't you? They're not. They're Venetian blind marks. Come on, Al-Anon. My son was an alcoholic, and he stayed out 13, 14, 15 years old. I never knew really what he was doing and how much he was drinking, but today he has been sober, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 4 years. And he married a girl in AA just over 8 years. But one of the things that Dick did for me, and I have two or three short, quick stories, and then I saw a lady looking at her watch. I have a couple of quick stories, but one of the things I wanted to tell you was about Dick. And he is my friend today, and Linda knows what I'm talking about. He's my running buddy. He's my companion. He's my friend. He's my lover. He's a lot of things to me. He is my husband. But the most important thing he is to me is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous and his membership in Alcoholics Anonymous comes far before anything else. Because if it were not for our memberships in Alcoholics Anonymous and our attendance at meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsoring people, we wouldn't be married today. And I'm sure of that. But our first Christmas, we had no money. He was paying alimony and child support, and we had no money. So we had agreed not to buy each other any Christmas presents. So that Christmas Eve, he came home. And he said to me, I have a Christmas present for you. And the first thing that happened to me was I got mad. Because I thought, this was our agreement that we were not going to buy any Christmas presents because we don't have any money. And he's gone off and broken our agreement and gotten me a Christmas present. And then the next thing I felt was guilt because I hadn't thought of it. And I didn't go out and get him one, and I was mad at myself. So he went into the bathroom. Now, we had a little efficiency apartment that had a front door, a balcony door, and a bathroom door, and that was it. He went into the bathroom, and within a very short period of time, the door flung open of that bathroom. He came jumping out of that bathroom, stark naked, and he had a big red bow tied you know where. And he's snapping his fingers and he's singing, here comes Santa Claus. Now, when I got sober, when I was drinking, apparently I must have participated in activities. But I was always so drunk. People would say, you really had a good time last night. And I'd say, oh, well, you know, because I didn't know whether I had a good time or not. But when I sobered up, sex was like, what? You want to do what? And I'd say, shh, you're making a noise. I mean, I was really, really blue-lipped about the whole thing. I defy you to be blue-lipped with a guy who comes out with a red bow tied you know where. It opened my whole perspective to that sort of thing. It was just like wonderful. I mean, and he was wonderful about it. He loosened me up, you know? I mean, it was wonderful. I could enjoy that whole avenue.
which was totally closed to me before, because it was so silly. You know, it was silly. He had got a Halloween mask one time, and tweak or tweak, you know, it was just great. He's, you know, that's the kind of thing that people who are in our mosaics of recovery are. They're little bright, funny, shiny stones in that mosaic of recovery. And we met, you know, we moved and we started meetings and we had children and one was born dead and he carried me through. He carried me through it. And he just had a really big operation and I was really terrified. Because I thought there was a chance I could lose my friend. And I'd had enough death for a year. Two friends had died from AIDS. And a patient of mine who had stayed out there one drink too long had died unexpectedly. And she was the one who was a little mosaic in my the little tiny stone in my recovery of. I sponsored her and she had a couple art galleries and I do watercolors. And I've learned so much from doing watercolors. I have learned to wet the paper and drop in the color and use my skill and let God do the rest. And I've learned that in sponsoring people. Because when you mess with it too much, all you get is mud. And Ginger said to me, why don't I give you a show? Why don't you paint me some pictures and I'll give you a show because you've helped me so much. So I worked like a fool and I got a whole bunch of watercolors. We had the show. And I sold over half of them the first night. I sold 18 watercolors the first night. And now, you know, I was always embarrassed or something to say, I'm an artist. But Ginger allowed me the dignity to say, I'm an artist. That she said was important to me, and she died, and then she was gone from my life, and I didn't want to lose Dick, you know. I just, I could take it, I could go on, I would go on, I can survive. I know we find that out. I could survive, but I wouldn't. It wouldn't be the same. And any of you who are married to people in the program know what I mean. It just wouldn't be the same, but. I need have no fear. He's too mean to die. He just came through this. He didn't even stay in intensive care decently. He was only in there 12 hours. He's supposed to be in there 24, and they put him back on the ward and stuff, and that's good. But this has been a good life, and I've learned so many things. You know, it's like being surrendered to my character defects. I developed a fear of flying, and I fly a lot. Actually, it's not a fear of flying. I love to fly. It's crashing and burning. I don't want to do it. And several years ago, I was to speak in Little Rock, and I got on this tiny plane, and the lady from the ground came and said, someone is going to have to get off. We're too heavy. And I thought, oh, great. And this man with a bunch of cameras got off, and then she balanced us. This is like 12 seats in this plane. And we were supposed to land in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and we came in to land, and it was rough. Oh, God, it was rough. And I was grasping my medallion, you know, and I was praying like crazy, and I was saying things, you know, it was really, really, really rough. And
the guy started to go into land, and he decided not to, and he took back off because the runway was sheer ice, and the stall alarm and the plane went off, you know, and the curtain was flapping, and we were, and I was sweating like a pig, you know, and I mean, I'm just praying up a storm, and I'm going, oh God, I'll cook dinner 5 nights a week, I promise you. I'll go to meetings, I won't yell at my pigeons, I won't, you know, I won't tell them what ninnies they are, I won't call them whiners ever again, I'll be good to them, I promise you, I'll be good to them, and, you know, and I, because I thought really I was going to die. It was bad. And I heard this rustling behind me, and I turned around, and this woman behind me had this big paper sack, and she pulled a bottle of Smirnoff's vodka out of it. She took the cap off of that bottle, she took a big slug out of it, and I felt better. God sent me that woman with the bottle of vodka. See, my God can be anything I want it to be. It says it so. And my God sent me that lady with the bottle of vodka. Because, see, he sends me that stuff all the time. He sends me from people from Charlotte up here to make me feel better. He sends me Sandy. He sends me Stacy. He sends me Dennis and Charlene. He sends me Creighton, of all strange things, to make me feel better. But he sends me these things. It's up to me to recognize his gift. It's always been up to me to recognize his gift. I spent years and years and years drinking and isolating myself from people and insulating myself from God. And now he says, surprise, see me in ordinary things. Peek-a-boo, it's me. I was in San Jose, California speaking. 5,000 people. 10,000 eyeballs. Saturday night. I'm scared to death. Have you got people that talk to you in your neighborhood? Mine get up there and they don't listen to anyone. They just talk. And the one will say, oh, what are you doing? You little broad from Nebraska. You're going to go up there. You're going to get up on that stage and you're going to faint. That's what you're going to do in your whole life. You've never fainted, but tonight's the night. You're going to faint. And you're going to get up there and not going to be able to say anything. And you're just going to, they won't even give you your plane ticket. Nee, 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 nee. Just easy, easy. Mind chatter. Just whining and yakking and puling and and I had gone up and put on my yellow silk speaking dress, and we were watching this play called Sadie the South, and I'm sitting there outside in this beautiful grassy amphitheater watching Sadie the South. This friend, who's my fuss budget friend, was sitting next to me, and I felt something wet hit my hand, and I looked up. I thought it was raining. I looked down. It was white. And I thought, oh, and this fuss budget friend of mine says, ew, ew, a bird has crapped on your back. And it was all over my shoulder. I mean, that bird was sick. It was sick. Oh, my God, it was horrible. And all of a sudden, it was like everything was all right. It was like, you're just supposed to carry the crap, that's all. You're just supposed to, that's all you gotta do. You don't have to be you just carry the damn stuff. You know, you don't have to be anybody. You're just Peggy from Nebraska. You've got crap on your dress. You show them the crap, that's all you have to do. That's all, for some people, birds sing. You know, for me, they crap. But that's what God did. He sent me that bird in San Jose. In South Carolina. Because this is the most important thing that we're supposed to learn. It says it in the book. To find a power greater than ourselves is what this book is all about. We never had it, did we? We tried to do it. Creighton was talking about the Happy Island. For God's sake, if you didn't hear him, get the tape. The Happy Island. We tried to make things right. We tried to put a moat around ourselves. We tried to insulate ourselves from people. We tried to be like David, the boy in the bubble. We tried to keep ourselves insulated from people and isolated from everything so we wouldn't hurt. But when we came to AA, we had to be vulnerable. It's the worst thing in the world for me. Just feel. Feel. Sit there and feel. Be human. Have emotion. You know those people that you see walking around meetings, the back, pacing and muttering? You think those are new people. They're sponsors. We're feeling. We're feeling. We're thinking, I'll get her. Why would she think she is talking to her sponsor like that? I'm sending out the AA police. Break her arms. But that's it. You know, we have to learn how to become vulnerable. And the most important thing is we need to find this consistent, persistent power that's greater than we are that will never fail us. It's like that air conditioning in this place. If it's plugged in, it works. If it's not plugged in, it's useless. It's like me. If I'm plugged in, I work. If I'm not, I'm useless. And when I was in South Carolina with Linda and Hank last December, the most amazing thing happened. And it was God. Sometimes I tell people this story and they look at me like, well, she's getting old, you know, and she doesn't know, you know, she's getting a little dottery. But it means something to me. Because it's another one of God's challenges. See me in this. See me in this. We went to this place called the Sea Captain's House for supper. And I love the sea. Do you like the sea? I love it. It's so powerful. It's so deep and mysterious. And we went to this sea captain's place. And it was dark. And when we came into the parking lot, they were doing some construction behind this restaurant, and they had this big construction light. And when we walked to the end of the parking lot, out on the ocean in the pitch dark were all these seagulls. Thousands and thousands and thousands of seagulls. All sitting there, not doing anything, like visiting or something. You know, they were just sitting there. Thousands. And so when we went into the restaurant, I said to the lady, what's with the birds? And she said, we really don't know. They just came here a few months ago. They stay here at night. But we think it's the light. We think it's the light. And that's what it is in AA. It's the light. When you go to your meeting, do you see the light? When you look in your sponsor's eyes, do you see the light? I do. That light is God's love. It's safety. It's healing. It's forgiveness. It's joy. And all of these things I've received because I was surrendered. There was a man walking on the beach. And there had been a storm the night before. And in the distance, the man who was walking saw a man who was throwing something back into the ocean. And the man was walking, as he got closer, to the man who was throwing, noticed that the sand was littered with starfish that had been washed up by the storm the night before. And the man who was walking said to the man who was throwing, "What are you doing?" And the man who was throwing said, "I'm throwing these starfish back in the ocean so that they can live, because they can't live out here on the beach." And the man who was walking said to the man who was throwing, "But what possible difference can it make? There are thousands of them." And the man who was throwing said, "It makes all the difference in the world to this one." You've made all the difference in the world to this one. So I don't have to die alone in a cheap apartment. Nobody cares. All because I gave up.
The original master recording cut off at this point.